0-1 pitch. A swing and another high drive belted to deep right. Oh, forget about it. 3-0 Indians. Jay Bruce with a towering two-run homer to right. Swung on, blasted high and deep to right center field. Way out of here again. Jay Bruce has his first two-homer game with the Tribe.
It's not productive. You know, if we were 3-8, it'd be the same thing. You show up and you want to win the game you're playing. But we'll turn the page real quick because it seems like we got a day off tomorrow. We don't. So we got a lot of baseball, and that's okay. We'll be glad to be home. Two things are for sure. We'll have our fans and clean underwear.
High fly ball deep to right center field. A long run for Hernandez and Puig, and falls between them. Here come the two. It's like a relay race, one behind the other. Here they come together. Two of them score. Kinsler and Jacoby Jones on a double by Cabrera. Swing and a miss. Strike three. He got him looking. In there. Strike three. Ground ball pulled wide at third, and they get the force at second, and he gets a big hand. They're on their feet. What a showing by Verlander.
I thought Verlander was outstanding. He was attacking the hitters. Slider was really good today. He looked like Justin Verlander.
Felt great. Went out there against the best team in baseball, and really this morning just kind of told myself I'm going to try to take a playoff-type intensity out there and not let these guys sweep us. You know, and it's impossible to really create playoff atmosphere without being in the playoffs. Tried my best to do that and just kind of there's that much more focus and intensity in every pitch. And for whatever reason, I guess that kind of locked me in a little more. It's just one of those things.
Still got a ways to go, but like the way it's trending. Some guys in there that will make some plays for us, and they're pretty active. We've been pleased with the progress. You know, Matthew was able to get the ball out and not have to deal with a lot of undue pressure, except for on a touchdown pass to Marvin. It was he got hit pretty good there, but other than that, it was fairly clean with him in that group. Just like anything else, I'll tell you, week to week, everything changes. You know, you guys will be asking the question, well, what happened to Galladay this week or something of that nature, but when I explain to you that it just kind of depends on what happens defensively, what they're playing, where we attack them in terms of the weaknesses, what they're giving us. So you could have Golden have a big day one time, Marvin the next. It could be someone else later on. But so you don't always see a situation where a guy will catch, an inordinate number of passes. We just take it week to week.
Just another year under our belt. I think another year in the system. For him, another year in the system for me, familiarity with it. I thought really all our guys on the outside played well today. Caught the ball at a high rate, which was a good thing. Golden obviously had a couple nice catches as well. Marvin played, really well. So, we'll look at the tape. Always stuff to clean up, but those guys played well.
I think the team is really competitive on both sides of the ball. I think it's a group that will get after you. I think we're physically better than where we were a year ago. I think we're more mentally tougher. I think we're stronger. Like I said, I think it's a better roster. Still have some questions to solve, obviously, the quarterback situation, and we'll get that. Playing guys in some positions still to find out how they fit, where they fit. But for the most part, I think we have a good idea of who we are defensively, who we are offensively, and who we are on special teams. Now it's just fine-tuning some things.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Here we are, Toledo Sports Leader. Did you catch all that? If you didn't catch all that, you feel like I felt trying to catch that eclipse. What the hell did I miss here, huh? I mean, I looked up and I waited and I waited and I waited and I waited, and the only thing I came up with at the end of the day was
boring.
Yeah, exactly, Homer. The crowd gathered round, everybody stared up at the sky looking for some sort of thing they'll never see again in 100 years or 7 years, depending on who you listen to. And as the hush fell over the crowd, one lone voice said it all.
Boring.
Yeah, it was. Cushlin, you said you saw a crescent? You saw... Now, you had the glasses.
Yes, I ended up having the glasses, yes.
See, I did not get glasses because two things. Number one, the way the media, not us, media that covers this sort of thing, science-y type things, right?
Yeah.
The way they painted it, to me anyway, as I understood Eclipse 2017 jargon to be, the glasses were just to protect you if you wanted to stare right at the sun to see the eclipse. They're just, so you don't have vision damage. It can actually cause blindness if you stare at it. That's why every science-y type person in the world said, don't look straight at the eclipse unless you have the special glasses on. Okay. So I said, I didn't plan to look straight at the eclipse anyway. I'm not stupid. I'm not going to stare straight at the sun to see something pass in front of it and burn my retinas out. So I figure I don't need the glasses. I'll just kind of look off to the side, just kind of experience the, you know, the sky around me getting dim. Not black, because we're not in the 100% blackout zone, 100% eclipse zone, obviously, which started up in Oregon in the great Pacific Northwest, went through Wyoming, into Nebraska, through to Missouri, through, I want to say, part of Illinois, through, I want to say, Tennessee?
Yep, yeah, a little bit of Kentucky, some Tennessee.
A little bit of Kentucky, then North Carolina, and then finally ending the full 100% blackout zone for Eclipse 2017. It was supposed to be Charleston, South Carolina. Because I saw that path earlier this morning. And, okay, well, I know we're not going to get 100%. That's the path for the 100%. Up in northern Ohio, from what I was told, is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of what? Around 80%, 82%, 83%,
yep.
Somewhere in that neighborhood?
Yep.
So I said, okay, it won't be a 100% blockage of the sun, but it'll be an 82 or 83 or 84% blockage of the sun. Super. It'll get dim. It'll be like dusk. It won't be like, you know, nighttime when the sun is blocked, but it'll be, you know, when the sun starts to go down toward the end of the day kind of a thing. I didn't get that sensation at all. I didn't look around and think, it's darker now. I didn't even feel dimmer now. And as I looked, and here's the other thing, Jim. I was told by a source that I feel like I can trust, my wife. And she said that she was told or read or something that if you just want to look at it without hurting your eyes, get your cell phone out, turn it on the reverse-facing camera, the front-facing camera, point that up at the sky, and then just look at it in your phone, and you will be able to see everything without the glare of the sun blinding you. So that's what my wife and I did half an hour ago. So look, there it is. She showed me what she got. I sent her what I got. Whole lot of nothing. Whole lot of nothing. Just a sunny sky with a bunch of cloud cover is all it really was. So I didn't see any crescent. I didn't see any anything. And now, come to find out what people are telling me, Cushlin, is that it wasn't the glasses weren't just to protect your eyes from going blind or suffering vision damage, that you needed the glasses to see the event, to see the crescent. It wasn't just don't stare at the sun unless you have those glasses on. It was if you want to see anything celestial, then you need to have the glasses. Well, why the hell did they do that? Why didn't they tell us that from the get-go? They made it sound like it was just protective.
Yeah, and I did have the glasses, and that's why I was able to see a little bit of a, you know, of a crescent.
Did you know from the beginning that it was you needed them to see an actual, you know, massive 82% blockage of the sun with the moon in order to see it? Or did you just think, if I want to look up there and see the thing without burning my eyes out, I got to have the special protective glasses?
And to me, it was more the latter, and I'd been hearing grumblings about that for a couple of weeks now. And the only other option was to do something my late grandfather would have done when I was a kid, and the last time there was something like this.
Yeah.
And you do the little, you gotta poke the pinholes and look through kind of like a box to get the reflection. That's how I did it ages ago when the last time one of these came along, because they didn't have those kind of glasses, though.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They didn't, and like I said, you know, the pinhole thing, I didn't really understand either, so I didn't even bother with that. But like I said, the cell phone thing is what I was told, and all I know is, you know, from the time, you know, it was supposed to be at its peak darkness, you know, for here, which is 82-83% blockage, I didn't notice, and there wasn't a noticeable dimming of the sky around us, and there wasn't a crescent of any kind form that you could see unless you probably had the glasses. So it sounds like it was the glasses aren't just for protection against blindness. The glasses have a component to them that are necessary to actually see the moon pass in front of the sun at 82%.
And that's basically what I found out, because again, the last time one of these happened, they didn't have those kind of glasses, because that was very early 90s or very late 80s. I can't remember when it was, but it was in that ballpark. So yeah, you would have had to have the glasses.
The last total eclipse that was supposed to be visible here in North America, as I understand it, was 38 years ago.
Right.
That's longer than early 90s.
Yeah. Okay.
So I mean I mean there may have been a partial one.
There was a partial partial one like in the very early 90s because I remember hanging out with my late grandfather in his driveway and we were doing the pinhole thing in a box kind of thing that day.
Yeah, the last full total eclipse that was visible anywhere in North America or, you know, here in the United States certainly was supposed to be 38 years ago. Then the last time it was visible from coast to coast, from one end of the country to the other, the way it was today, was 100 years ago. 1918 was the last time that went down. So this is a pretty unique thing. Now, there's another total eclipse coming in 7 years. So you might say, oh, it's no big deal. It's coming back. That one will only be visible from Texas, parts of Texas, and then the course of the 100% blackout or, you know, blockage will run up through New England. So instead of coast to coast, it's kind of more south to northeast, you know, south central to northeast.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, that still won't be the same thing as they had 100 years ago.
But I will say this, because I found that by accident over the weekend, because, you know, they can measure those kind of things when these things are going to happen down the line. And, yeah, that is the day for us in Toledo or even as far east as Cleveland. That's the day to essentially, you know, mark on your calendar, Monday, April 8th, 2024, because we here in Toledo will be in the 100% blackout mode for that one.
Okay, so that's part of that, like I said, that course that goes
you know,
from Houston and then up, you know, through the Midwest, like Ohio, and then up toward the Northeast.
Exactly. So for guys like you, Bob, the one 7 years from now, that'll be the more entertaining one because that's when we will have the full blackness over Toledo.
And I guess
Toledo.
I better get some damn glasses for that one because.
Well, you have enough warning on that one now, don't you?
Yeah, but I mean, I had enough warning on this one too, Jimmy. But the way they made it sound, it was protective. And I was like, well, I don't need the protection because I'm not stupid. I don't plan on looking straight at it. If anything, I'll look on my phone or I'll look off to the side and just kind of see the darkness around and, you know, kind of catch a little glimpse. But I'm not going to stare at the sun or even look at it directly, even with the, you know, 82% of it blocked or anything else. I just, you know, I didn't need the protection, so I didn't get any glasses. Now I come to find out, well, it wasn't just that. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's hard to, I'm trying to think of a metaphor and an analogy for the situation, and I can't think of one where they tell you this is just for protection, but you can't. Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of going to a rock concert and they're saying here, get these special earplugs so you don't blow your ears out if you're near the speakers at a rock concert. And I'm like, all right, but you know what? I don't plan on sitting that close anyway. And I'm making this up as I go, so I hope it makes some sense. I don't plan on sitting close to the speakers. I'm, you know, 40 rows back anyway, so I don't need the earplugs. And then come to find out they were more than earplugs. They actually, you know, enhanced the sound. And, oh, I didn't get to hear squat. I guess that didn't work. I'm just making it up as I go because I'm trying to figure out some other way to explain how silly this was. And it bugs me because I wanted to see the damn thing. And I posted on Facebook, Cushlin, what a letdown this was.
Yeah.
I even posted a link. 2-3 seconds of The Simpsons and the huge crowd of Homer going
boring,
and because that's how it seemed to me. And other people are posting pictures, probably like what you saw through your glasses. No, look, there's a crescent. No, look, there's a, you know, damn it.
You know what? With the Simpsons reference you're throwing in this, there's one more clip. We got to find the one where at the end of the episode, now let's go burn down the observatory so this will never happen again.
Yes, that was Bart's comet.
Right, yes.
That was when the comet was going to incinerate Springfield, and it ended up burning up in the atmosphere and becoming no bigger than the head of a chihuahua. I don't know why I remember these things. Do you know how smart I would be, Jim Cushlin, if I would clean out all of the crap that takes up space in my brain and replace it with...
Oh, I'm right there with you. You don't have to explain to me. I know exactly that feeling.
I knew it was a chihuahua from the episode you're talking about. You're right. Oh, thank God we survived. Now let's go burn down the observatory so this will never happen again. Oh, priceless. Priceless. All right, what else is going on? It is supposed to be a sports show of some sort or another, if I'm not mistaken. So what else is going on besides scientific, what do you want to call that? Scientific observation, scientific letdown, which is what it was for me. Oh, yeah. Here's something that didn't let you down over the weekend. If you are a Detroit Lions fan, how about you undefeated Lions?
Daniel Diggs!
Woo! Kush? Are my eyes deceiving me, or are the Lions undefeated? Are the Lions off to a 2-0 start in the 2017 season?
They are indeed off to a 2-0 start in the 2017 preseason.
Wait, what's this pre you speak of? You mean these don't count?
No, of course not. And for Lions fans, they'll be quick to point out how really useless it was, because I've heard, not a year goes by, Bob, that I don't hear from some Lions fan about the 0-16 year, how the Lions went 4-0 that preseason.
That's true. I didn't even think about that. But I do remember last year talking about that. Yeah, we get a little giddy and have a little bit of fun. 2-0 are the Lions. You don't take much away from the 2-0. But what you do take away are some positive things. In particular, your quarterback play. Matthew Stafford looks, he looks like he's going to be ready. And in what you may call mid-season form at the start of the season, he was sharp against the New York Jets. He was 8 out of 10 for 84 yards. And then you take away the defense. That's what you take away from this, too. Christian Hackenberg was left embarrassed. Bryce Petty didn't fare a whole heck of a lot better. And the Lions defense kind of did some things and made some progress, 16-6. So they've beaten the Colts now. They've beaten the Jets now. What's left? Patriot. Oh, yeah. I got to do the Patriot thing. Not that that'll mean anything either. But the Patriot thing comes up on when? Friday, right, Coach?
That's a Friday night game, and we'll have it for you. Got to shift it over to Talk Radio 100.7 for opening Friday night of high school football.
Yes, of course. And then they wrap up the preseason with the most ridiculously stupid of all of them, the one in which nobody plays except for the guys who are going to be cut. They'll play the Bills in that one on August 31st. Okay. So you've got the Lions with a victory, and that's nice to see. We'll talk a little bit more about what they did and what looked good and who looked good, and Kenny Golladay continuing to make some jaws flap. Very interesting about Matthew Stafford, by the way, not having to do with this game, Kush, but a story that, and I always like these kind of stories. I like these ranking things. These things just kind of are fun for talk radio. But a very interesting one where a prominent analyst, if you will, has decided that Matthew Stafford is a top 10 quarterback in the National Football League. He has ascended from the position of next tier down into that top 10, passing the likes of Cam Newton, passing up the likes of Eli Manning and Kirk Cousins. That Matthew Stafford has earned the right to be in the top 10. And my response to that would be, he damn well better be if he's going to be paid the most money of any quarterback in the history of the sport, which is kind of where those contract negotiations are very likely headed. But we'll talk a little bit about Stafford. We'll talk a little bit about some of the other important weapons that the Lions are going to need and see how they looked in game number 2. And then we're going to talk about that defense, which, you know, and I'm trying to be positive here. I'm trying to be optimistic for all of the right reasons. But I'm not blind and I'm not stupid. I realize it was the Jets offense that they were playing against in this preseason game. It was Christian Hackenberg and Bryce Petty and not a real professional quarterback on that roster. But you know what? You don't diminish what you have. You want to look at the positive, and right now they looked positively solid against that particular NFL offense, the one belonging to the Jets. So we'll get into that a little bit. Coming up, we're going to talk to whom? We're going to talk to Jeremy Reisman. Of PrideOfDetroit.com coming up at about 3:35. We'll talk to him about the Lions win. And then we're going to talk at 4:10 with a preview, not a review, but a preview of tonight's NFL preseason action as the Cleveland Browns are back at it again. And Scott Petrak, our good friend from the Browns, is going to be joining us to preview that game. Okay, they're taking on the Eli Manning / Odell Beckham Jr. New York Giants. So we'll get into that with Scott. And then, just to round it out, we got a full football day today coming up at about 4:40 or 4:35 or so. We're going to talk about college football. ESPN Top 25 poll was released just 3 hours ago at noon today. And, yeah, as expected, the Alabama Crimson Tide received 52 of the 61 first-place votes from the media panel, and they are the number one team in the preseason Top 25. So we're going to talk a little bit to our man, Chris Lowe. Chris is going to join us from ESPN.com about the college football top 25 release today from ESPN.com. So that's what's coming up. Want you to be a part of it if and when you get a chance. Dial 866-240-1065. And Mr. Cushlin, what do you say we get wild?
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
The Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day comes to you from Mr. Cushlin today. And Cushlin, let's hope it's better than the one that I had to overrule you on last week. And I think it is. How about your boy Justin Verlander, still a Tiger and still doing things? He has been red hot since the trade deadline passed. He was much rumored to be a part of that trade deadline. In five starts from July 30th and the end of the deadline, or end of the trading period, through yesterday, Verlander's 4-1 with a 2.06 ERA, showing that in five starts, so he is not washed up. And maybe his win over the Dodgers yesterday was an audition for the Houston Astros. Maybe a trade still can be worked out to help the Tigers replenish that that barren farm.
They got 10 days for that.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Still can make a waiver deadline trade. There you go. Opponents hitting just 175 off of Justin Verlander. He has struck out 39 in 35 innings since that actual regular trading deadline. So that is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. All right, going to get a quick timeout here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk, as I said, a little bit of Lions football. I got some Brian Regan tickets we're going to give you in the next half hour as well. All right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Let's go burn down the observatory so this will never happen again.
France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling onward on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Phone lines open at 866-240-1065, kind of, sort of. Kind of open because I can't take your calls right now because I got a guest I want to talk to, but kind of open so that you can get in line and I'll go to you right when I'm done with him. How does that sound? Hey, but you know what else I also want to remind you of? Something you already know, and Buffalo Wild Wings knows too. Fantasy football commissioners, that's a tough job. You're under a lot of pressure. So if you want to make a good impression on your league owners and make it look like a first-class league, it starts with the perfect draft day party. Create instant league cred. When you book your draft party at B-Dubs, you get a free draft kit along with a special draft feast of boneless wings, three sides, and three shareables, all at a special price to feed your whole league. So come on in to start your fantasy season right at Buffalo Wild Wings at participating locations while supplies last. And don't forget the B-Dubs Fast Break lunch menu, too. All the highlights from the menu at discounted prices every Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports. All right. If you're at B-Dubs, you probably enjoyed watching the Detroit Lions move to 2-0 on the preseason. Joining us now is Jeremy Reisman of PrideOfDetroit.com to talk about the 2-0 Lions. Hey, Jeremy, how are you, man?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
I'm great. Feeling good. A little disappointed at the Eclipse. I didn't experience it perhaps the right way. How'd you do?
I stayed indoors. My eyes are bad as is. I don't want to risk it.
You're also just smarter than everybody else because, you know what? You know how many people flew in from out of the country just to get in the 100% total path of this eclipse to watch 2.5 minutes, watch the sky go dark, and then brighten back up again? Talk about having disposable income. People are just all over the place. Anyway, I was less than impressed, so I'm not happy about that. But if you're a Lions fan, you got to be happy right now with 2-0. Does it count if you beat a JV team like the Jets in the preseason? Does that mean a whole heck of a lot? You know, it's kind of like a varsity team against a JV team in a scrimmage.
Well, it's the preseason, so nothing counts anyways. But, yeah,
I think you'd like to feel good about a preseason win. But do you if it's a JV team that you're playing?
To me, I didn't really take a whole lot from this game. I don't think you can necessarily look at it and say, hey, the Lions are much better than we thought. The one way that you could possibly spin it in a positive way is that last year the Lions didn't really distinguish themselves from bad teams in the NFL. You know, they lost to the Bears. They struggled against the Jaguars. It's pretty clear through both the Jets and the Colts game that they distinguished themselves from some pretty bad teams. But we'll see how they stand up to some good teams next week when they play the Patriots.
That's a very fair way to look at it. You're distinguishing yourself from bad teams. You do want to show some separation there, and I think they've done that. And, boy, the Jets really are one of the NFL's bad teams. You know, you talk about a quarterback situation. I don't know who's worse, Jacksonville's or the Jets or maybe the 49ers. But Christian Hackenberg, Bryce Petty, I mean, if you want to get a good evaluation of your defense, you don't want to be playing the Jets because that's not a real semblance of an NFL offense.
No, not at all. But again, a way to positively spin that is to say, well, at least you're building some confidence for this defense that really struggled last year. They've looked outstanding in the first halves of both games. They've only given up 3 points in the first half of both these games. And obviously, it's a little more important how these teams do in the first half than it is the second half.
No question about that. Let's talk a little bit about the offensive side of the ball. Then we'll talk about that defense against the atrocious Jets offense. Matthew Stafford in the limited opportunities, 8 for 10. Obviously, you'll take that every day, 80% completion rate. And again, you know, the Jets defense isn't as bad as its offense, but it's not the best measuring stick. But you take what you can from it. 8 for 10 for 84 yards with a touchdown. You're getting some good production from some young guys like you did in game number one. What impressed you most about the offense?
I think it was the connection between Stafford and Marvin Jones. That's something that we saw kind of fade away last year. Yeah. It looked right back where it started last year. That was a perfectly laid fade throw to him in the end zone. And we saw Marvin Jones do what he does best, and that's kind of work the sidelines, work in tight coverage, but come down with the ball. And so that's something that I think Lions fans are going to be very promised about, and hopefully that's something that rolls over into the regular season and beyond.
Who else besides Marvin Jones impressed you?
I'd say Michael Roberts. He didn't get a lot of time with the ones. I don't think he got any time with the ones. But the rookie tight end is someone who struggled in the first game, had a drop, had a couple fumbles, one that was called back. Mm-hmm. He made a really, really nice catch on a tight throw from Jake Rudock. Picked up some yak on that, too. So I think he had about two catches for 27 yards. That was a big rebound game for him. And that's someone who the Lions might be relying on a lot this year, especially with Eric Ebron still sitting out of practice.
We talked about him last week. In fact, we talked about him going into the preseason game number one, just as camp was going on, about how important he might be because of the injury to Ebron. And then he had that stinker in game number one. You know, of course, he's a Toledo product, so he's, on the minds of a lot of Rockets fans here where we are in Northwest Ohio. And then he had that kind of a clunker, as you pointed out, a drop and a couple of fumbles. So it's good to see him bounce back. Is this a guy that you think has what it would take to, to make some positive contributions as a rookie?
Yeah, at least a little bit. I know the Lions are probably going to be happy with their top two in Darren Fells and Eric Ebron, and we'll still wait to see when/if Ebron is going to be ready for the regular season. But I do think Michael Roberts is going to get a significant amount of playing time. Maybe it's only 10, 15 snaps a game, but he'll have his opportunities. And I think a lot of people are anticipating him to really be a red zone threat. So when the Lions go 2-3 tight end sets, when they get down deep in their opponent's territory, Roberts might get some opportunities to haul in some touchdowns. And that's exactly what he did last year as a senior with Toledo. So I'm optimistic about him, but it's something that we'll still have to see, because these drops apparently weren't just an issue in the preseason game. That's something that beat writers have seen during training camp. So, Saturday was a step in the right direction for him, but we'll continue to monitor it. I think the jury's still out on him.
I don't want to overdo it on one position, Jeremy, but just real quick, what does it say that they just signed Scott Orndorff, who was recently released by the Steelers? He had some pretty good numbers for the University of Pittsburgh, not the Steelers, University of Pittsburgh last season. So he was an undrafted rookie. Now the Lions just picked him up.
I wouldn't read too much into it. The Lions had four tight ends that sat out on Saturday's game, so this just might be a bodies type thing. Eric Ebron, Tim Wright, Kari Lee, Colwick all sat out of Saturday's game with an injury. I think a couple of them did return to practice today, but in general, this seems like kind of a camp body type situation. The Lions probably see a little bit of potential in him as both a blocker and a receiver, but he's kind of got a long ways to go, I think, to make this roster.
Okay. Now, of course, you can't talk about the Lions offense without talking about their Achilles heel a year ago, and that is the running game. Amir Abdullah was out the entire game. Now you got he is back and hopefully going to be healthy for an entire season. And Dwayne Washington got the most carries in the game against the Jets. He had 8 carries for 24 yards and unimpressive 3 yards a carry. Abdullah, 4 for 16. What are you seeing out of this running back group? Is there potential for production from Abdullah himself? I guess I have to really ask, not just beyond Abdullah, but let's say from him himself, and then, of course, beyond that, so that this can be a more balanced offense.
Well, I think Amir Abdullah looks pretty good for what the offensive line gave him. Only 4 rushes, 16 yards, as you mentioned, 4.0 a carry. But I think the running game in general is got to be a pretty big concern. If there's one thing the Jets do well, it's their front four. They got a pretty good defensive line. But this was a Lions offensive line that we expected to be much better this year, and they didn't look it on Saturday. They got T.J. Jones back, who played for the first two series. Rick Wagner is back and healthy, and the only missing part of that starting offensive line was Taylor Decker, and the Lions are probably going to be without him for at least a month or two. So I was hoping to see a lot more out of that offensive line on Saturday, and I didn't. And if anything happens to Amir Abdullah, I think this team is in even bigger trouble, because I didn't really see anyone impressed out there. You look around, like you said, Dwayne Washington had the best performance with 8 carries for 24 yards. As a team, they averaged 2.6 yards per carry. That's just not going to cut it at all. And at this point, the offense looks a lot like it did last year. And they were okay last year, but this is a team that I think a lot of people are expecting to have a top 10, maybe even a top 5 offense. And if the offensive line is performing as it is right now, they're not going to be that team.
We're talking to Jeremy Reisman, who writes about the Lions for PrideOfDetroit.com and SB Nation site. Jim Cushlin is with us as well, talking Lions. Jimmy, go ahead.
And let's stay on the offense one more time. We've obviously documented and talked with guys such as yourself over the last couple weeks during camp about where this offensive line is, based on especially some of the injuries that they've suffered. Where is some of our stats? I know it's a preseason game against, as Bob called them, the JV Jets, but what could we take out of some of the guys we did see online? Did anybody move up in the potential depth chart on some of these open line spots?
You know, I was looking for someone to make an impression on Saturday, and no one did in a positive way. One guy that I think a lot of Lions fans were hoping to take a big step this year and potentially jump into that starting lineup was Joe Dahl, and I think he's been very, very bad through two games. He was even worse on Saturday against the Jets. Just did not look like he was ready. He jumped in there at right guard to relieve T.J. Lang of little duties, and he just, you know, he didn't show anything. He looked lost. He looked like the small school prospect that he is, and that's got to be a little bit disheartening, because I think the jump from the first year to the second year for a lot of these young guys is really important, and Dahl just doesn't seem like he's there. As far as left tackle, which I think is the line's biggest concern, at this point it seems like it's Greg Robinson's job to lose. There's really no one behind him that's close. Cyrus Kwanjo got in there on Saturday for the first time, but he was only playing, I think, for the third and fourth quarter. He didn't get a lot of reps. He didn't make a very good impression. Greg Robinson was okay. I think he's better than most people expected him to be at this point, but he's also still very much a work in progress. So we'll see how he continues to develop in the final two preseason games.
Jeremy Reisman joining us from PrideOfDetroit.com, talking a little bit about the Lions win over the New York Jets. Let's talk a little bit more about defense now. As I mentioned a few moments ago, you know, the Jets offense is abysmal. It's one of the probably – is it the worst quarterback situation, do you think, in the league, looking at the guys that they have, or is it Bortles and the Bortles and Henny competition down in Jacksonville?
I think it's got to be the Jets, to be honest. Christian Hackenberg does not look like anything resembling a starting quarterback, and that was a head-scratcher of a pick from the get-go. I think some people at least believed in Bortles when he was drafted. I don't know a lot of people who was in Christian Hackenberg's corner when they picked him in the second round.
Are they tanking, do you think, real quick? Because a lot of people say they know that, everything that we just said about Hackenberg and about Bryce Petty, and they're in the Sam Darnold sweepstakes. This is what they want, is they want to necessarily go out, you know, not go out and lose intentionally. The players will play their butts off, but as an organization, they're not going to put everybody in the best position to be successful, because they feel like they need that franchise quarterback that could be coming out next year.
I guess if you want to word it that way, tanking, then yeah, in a way I kind of do think, a positive spin. I know I'm talking about all these positive spins. A way I would say it is they're building for the future, and they got rid of some hefty contracts with Eric Decker and some veteran guys who are kind of on the decline this offseason. But, they're not building to win this year. That's very much apparent from the moves they made. And whether that means they're going to go for Sam Darnold or maybe they're just trying to develop Christian Hackenberg, I don't know. But, you can definitely make the argument that they're tanking.
Jeremy, let's talk about the defense, the way they played and the way they have looked in two preseason games thus far, and what kind of how you think that portends for the future and the start of the season. Who jumped out at you? Who were you most impressed by? And who were you maybe surprised that you expected a little bit more from on the defensive side of the ball against the Jets?
One guy who stood out in both games that is a very pleasant surprise for the Lions is Anthony Zettel, the second-year defensive end. He was a guy who probably entering the year was a bubble roster guy. He might not have even made the team. Now, injuries have kind of forced him into the starting lineup during the preseason, and he rose to the challenge. He had a sack in the first game, nearly had another one in this game, three tackles, and he's just bringing constant pressure from the outside, and that's something the Lions absolutely need, especially with Ziggy still out, Kerry Hyder out for the year, Brandon Copeland out for the year. The Lions don't really have a clear number two guy once Ezekiel Ansah comes back, and at this point we don't even know when Ansah's coming back because he's still on that PUP list, and there's been no indication whether he's close to being ready. So Anthony Zettel is on my high list of good performances. Another guy who surprised me in a positive way was Akeem Spence. He was a big off-season addition at defensive tackle. He's someone who's gotten really bad reviews from his former teams. He wasn't a guy that a lot of people expected to get the kind of money that the Lions threw at him, but he had a phenomenal game against the Jets. He had a sack. He had another tackle for loss, I think, on the very next play. So he's a guy who is probably going to have a significant role as a depth player behind A'shaun Robinson and Haloti Ngata, and the Lions seemingly didn't have anyone behind those two. So to see Akeem Spence kind of take over that role is got to be a relief. In general, you look at Akeem Spence, you look at Anthony Zettel, and suddenly the Lions' defensive line doesn't look so bad. Of course, then you have to, like, settle into reality. This was the Jets. This was the Colts. We're not really sure where they stand right now.
That's a fair point. We're talking to Jeremy Reisman from PrideOfDetroit.com, talking about the Lions and about their victory over the Jets, how they look thus far through two games. We've got time for just a couple more quick ones. Jim Cushlin, go ahead, Jimmy.
On the defensive side, Jeremy, are there just like I kind of asked you with the offensive line, are there any position battles on that defensive side that came a little more into focus by what we saw back on Saturday?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I can answer the opposite of that one. The one position battle that I'm even more confused about, in a good way, though, is that nickel corner, because I thought Quandre Diggs and DJ Hayden both had phenomenal games against the Jets. They were both very, very good. Quandre Diggs surprisingly had a couple big plays on special teams, which is something that not a lot of people thought he had the talent for. And when a position battle is this close, being good on special teams is a great way to win that spot. So Quandre Diggs, DJ Hayden, that's something to definitely keep a strong eye on. In terms of guys who may have won their battle, I would say, I would say Akeem Spence. Like I said, there wasn't really a lot of clarity who was going to be the big backups behind Haloti Ngata, and A'shaun Robinson. And I think at this point, Akeem Spence has cleared the way as the number three defensive tackle on this team.
Last thing we'll let you run, Jeremy, and we certainly appreciate your time going back to the offense. Now, anytime I see these types of rankings, I'm intrigued with them because it's what we do. It's just fun conversation. Quarterback rankings. There is a national writer for the big lead, Jason McIntyre, who has declared Matthew Stafford has ascended into the top 10 now of NFL quarterbacks. A lot of people for the last few years have kind of seen him in that next tier down, maybe in the top 15, 16, certainly the top half of NFL quarterbacks, but now that he has cracked the top 10, ahead of the likes of Cam Newton, former MVP, ahead of Kirk Cousins, who's put up monster numbers the last couple of years for the Redskins, ahead of two-time champion Eli Manning. Here's the way they have it at the big lead with Jason McIntyre. Number one, of course, would be Tom Brady, even at age 40. Number two, Aaron Rodgers, tremendous talent that he is. Number three is Andrew Luck, which is a little surprising given his health situation and their offensive line situation and whether or not he can do the things that perhaps his talent says he can do. Then Matt Ryan, the reigning MVP, would be number four, followed by champion Russell Wilson, champion Drew Brees, Marcus Mariota, who has not even yet made the playoffs, but he's just a rising stud. Then Ben Roethlisberger, eight. Then who was not? Oh, then Kirk Cousins. Beg your pardon. Number nine was Derek Carr of the Raiders, who was an MVP candidate right up until he got hurt at the end of the season. And then Matthew Stafford. Kirk Cousins is down there at 11. So what has changed about his game that has earned that elevation in status? Do you think that is accurate?
Well, yeah, I do. First off, I do think that's accurate. I have them right around 8 or 9 in the league, so I'm kind of in line with them. Although I'm not quite buying into the Marcus Mariota hype as I think many others, and I'm with you with Andrew Luck. That seems a little bit high for him when, you know, you track Luck's career and it looks very much like Matthew Stafford's, except he has a couple playoff wins under his belt. But with Stafford, obviously he's getting a little more respect nationally, I think, because he made a lot of noise with all the comeback wins last year, you know, the short MVP run before December hit. But in terms of me personally, what I've seen change and make him a better quarterback has everything to do with his footwork. He was a guy who I thought did not see pressure very well, did not manage the pocket very well. And we've seen him not only scramble well, you know, I think he had his career high in rushing yards last year, and he's continually built that number over the past 2-3 years. But he's a guy who knows how to shift the pocket, knows how to set his feet when he needs to set his feet and fire the ball in there. And that's made him a better passer. It's made him a better runner, and it's made him avoid more sacks than he probably should have taken last year. So if there's something in his game that has really transformed, I think that's it.
Is this contract extension going to get done before the start of the season? And if not, is it a distraction? Is it a problem for anybody?
I think it does get done. I think I had mentioned before, either with Jim or you earlier, that I think this gets done in the last week, right before, in the lead up to the season. That's what Stafford's agent, his MO is. He's done that 3 or 4 years in a row where he extends he agrees to a contract for a franchise quarterback in the very last, right after the last preseason game, right before the start of the regular season. I think that's when it gets done. In terms of being a distraction, if it doesn't get done, Stafford has said all the right things so far in that he doesn't even think about it. The only time he ever thinks about it is when the media asks him about it. So he delegates that completely to his agent. Whether that's completely true or not, who knows? But he plays the part, and you know, it doesn't look like his play has been affected, or you know, has any mental issues, or it, you know, hasn't said anything negative about the team. So he'll probably get asked it a ton, which in lead could be a distraction just because he's being asked it. But I don't think Stafford's going to be thinking about it much.
Does he get $30 million a year?
I think he comes up just short of that, but closer than I think some people are saying. A lot of people are saying 26. I think it might be like 28 and a half.
All right, fair enough. Good stuff. Great analysis of the Alliance 2-0 preseason start. And then just kind of a look ahead at some of the things that are going to be affecting the club as we head toward week number one of the NFL season. Still two more preseason games to go. We'll continue to follow you on prideofdetroit.com. This is Jeremy Reisman, prideofdetroit.com and SB Nation site. Jeremy, great stuff, my friend. Thanks for the conversation today.
Anytime, man. Thanks for having me.
You got it. It's a pleasure. All right, good stuff there. So we wanted to get a little review of what the Lions did in preseason game number 2. Now we have to have a preview of what the Browns are going to do in preseason game number 2. Coming up after the top of the hour, we are going to talk with our friend Scott Petrak, who is a Browns beat writer, and we'll have his thoughts on what they're going to do and what they'll see and what they'll face and how they'll fare. With Brock Osweiler getting the start yet again at starting quarterback in this preseason. Toledo's own Deshaun Kizer will follow him to the field as the number 2 quarterback, followed by Cody Kessler, who seems to be the odd man out in that battle in Cleveland. So they'll take on Eli Manning, Odell Beckham. They have a lot more certain situation at QB there in New York with the Giants, but that'll be coming up after the top of the hour. Hey, I mentioned to you before that I had a pair of tickets to see comedian Brian Regan, who is outstanding, hilarious. It's going to be a great show at Stranahan on August 27, and we've got a pair of them right now for you if you would like to go. Be caller number 8, caller number 8, to this number, 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, and you can go see Brian Regan at Stranahan on the 27th. It will be a great time and a great show, that I can promise you. Petrak joins us on the other side for hour number 2 right here on ESPN 106.
Deal, one pitch. A swing and another high drive, belted to deep right. Oh, forget about it. 3-0 Indians. Jay Bruce with a towering 2-run homer to right. Swung on, blasted high and deep to right center field. Way out of here again. Jay Bruce has his first 2-homer game with the Tribe.
It's not productive. You know, if we were 3-8 would be the same thing. You show up and you want to win the game you're playing. But we'll turn the page real quick because it seems like we got a day off tomorrow. We don't. So we got a lot of baseball, and that's okay. We'll be glad to be home. Two things are for sure. We'll have our fans and clean underwear.
High fly ball deep to right center field. A long run for Hernandez, and Puig and falls between them. Here come the two. It's like a relay race, one behind the other. Here they come together. Two of them score. Kinsler and Jacoby Jones on a double by Cabrera. Swing and a miss. Strike three. He got him looking. In there. Strike three. Ground ball pulled wide a third, and they get the force at second, and he gets a big hand. They're on their feet. What a showing by Verlander.
I thought Verlander was outstanding. He was attacking the hitters. Slider was really good today. He looked like Justin Verlander.
Oh, great. Went out there against the best team in baseball, and really this morning just kind of told myself I'm going to try to take a playoff-type intensity out there and not let these guys sweep us. You know, and it's impossible to really create playoff atmosphere without being in the playoffs. Tried my best to do that and just kind of there's that much more focus and intensity in every pitch. And for whatever reason, I guess that kind of locked me in a little more. It's just one of those things.
Still got a ways to go, but like the way it's trending. Some guys in there that will make some plays for us, and they're pretty active. We've been pleased with the progress. You know, Matthew was able to get the ball out and not have to deal with a lot of undue pressure, except for on a touchdown pass to Marvin. It was he got hit pretty good there, but other than that, it was fairly clean with him in that group. Just like anything else, I'll tell you, week to week, everything changes. You know, you guys will be asking the question, well, what happened to Galladay this week or something of that nature, but when I explain to you that it just kind of depends on what happens defensively, what they're playing, where we attack them in terms of the weaknesses, what they're giving us. So you could have Golden have a big day one time, Marvin the next. It could be someone else later on. But so you don't always see a situation where a guy will catch, an inordinate number of passes. We just take it week to week.
Just another year under our belt. I think another year in the system. For him, another year in the system for me, familiarity with it. I thought really all our guys on the outside played well today. Caught the ball at a high rate, which was a good thing. Golden obviously had a couple nice catches as well. Marvin played, really well. So, we'll look at the tape. Always stuff to clean up, but those guys played well.
I think the team is really competitive on both sides of the ball. I think it's a group that will get after you. I think we're physically better than where we were a year ago. I think we're more mentally tougher. I think we're stronger. Like I said, I think it's a better roster. Still have some questions to solve, obviously, the quarterback situation, and we'll get that. Playing guys in some positions still to find out how they fit, where they fit. But for the most part, I think we have a good idea of who we are defensively, who we are offensively, and who we are on special teams. Now it's just fine-tuning some things.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Hour number two on Eclipse Day, which was, a washout day for me. Very, very underwhelming was I on Eclipse Day 2017. But hour number two is underway of the Extravaganza, which is anything but underwhelming. Hey, congratulations to Mark Kutsky?
That's right.
Did I get that right, Kush?
Yes, you did.
All right. I love when I get when I guess names right. Mark Kutsky of Toledo won the Brian Regan ticket, so he'll be going to see Brian Regan at the Stranahan on. When is that thing?
August 27th, this Sunday.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Look at that. It's coming right up. The day after. I should have known because the day after the McGregor and Mayweather fight, which, of course, is coming up this Saturday. So, anyway, congrats. And we'll have more tickets to give away the rest of the week for Brian Regan at Stranahan. Coming up on Sunday the 27th. Really good conversation with Jeremy Reisman from PrideOfDetroit.com on the Lions win. They're 2-0 in this preseason. You know who else is looking to be 2-0 on the preseason? Yeah, the Cleveland Browns. They host the New York Giants. It is Eli Manning versus Brock Osweiler. That's a fair fight, right? It is Odell Beckham Jr. versus Kenny Britt. That's not a fair fight, is it? They're not covering each other, but you understand the point. Joining us now to talk a little Browns and Giants, a little preview of where things stand for Hugh Jackson's team is our good friend Scott Petrak, who's on the Browns beat, joining us now from Cleveland on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, Scotty Petrak, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Bob. How are you, bud?
I'm great, man. By the way, I meant to say this last time we talked. Congratulations on the BrownsZone.com website. For those who don't know, you have a it's pretty much your own personal blog, if you will, your own personal site as a part of the newspapers that you write for. It is just 100% Browns coverage. written by and edited by and analyzed by Scott Petrak. So it's just a great thing. Browns, plural, B-R-O-W-N-S, zone, .com. So that's kind of cool. This is brand new this year, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, thanks. We thought it'd be a place to get all your coverage in one spot, you know, analysis, features, whatever. I'm going to try to add some new features to it once the season gets going.
Yeah, I love it. I really do. I've got a bookmark on my sports tab now because it is a great place to get, you know, all kinds of comprehensive coverage. You know, you've got actual game stories on there, but you also have your opinion pieces, your game notes, and side story notes, and so on and so forth. So it's very, very cool, and I like that. Your lead story today at BrownsZone.com is what everybody is going to be watching tonight, and that is the battle for the Browns' starting quarterback job. Brock Osweiler was not really supposed to be here, but yet here he is. DeShone Kizer wasn't supposed to be considered for this starting job at the beginning of the season. The Toledo Central Catholic product, the Notre Dame product, and yet here he is after an impressive preseason opener. So Brock gets snaps first tonight, DeShone after. What does Brock Osweiler need to do tonight to sew this thing up and make sure that the rookie, DeShone, is going to learn from the sideline for a while?
Yeah, you know, at first he needs to play better than he did in the opener against the Saints. No first downs, the first three drives. And the biggest problem with Brock that game, and it's really been throughout training camp, is he's overthrowing guys. And when you talk to the quarterback coach, David Lee, he brings up the fundamentals and your mechanics. In Osweiler, you know, he's 6'7", 6'8", and he's got a long stride, and they're trying to shorten it up. But when he kind of reverts back, then the ball sails on him. And we saw it. He tried to go downfield a number of times, and most of those were overthrown. So he needs to be more accurate is one, and he needs to get more help. You know, last week, Kenny Britt, you mentioned him against Odell Beckham. Kenny Britt had three chances to make plays for Brock in the end zone, near the end zone, and he didn't make them. One time he didn't get his foot down, his second foot down. Two times he couldn't get off coverage enough to get a completion. And, you know, when you look at the big-time quarterbacks, most of them have big-time receivers. And whoever's playing quarterback for the Browns, that's a struggle. So Brock just needs to be more accurate, and he needs to move the ball quicker. You know, you don't want to go three and out, because then the pressure starts to build.
That's a very good point. And let's talk about Kenny Britt. And it's not pick on him, Day, but, you know, you just said he had a chance to make plays for Brock at or near the goal line or the end zone, and he didn't make them. Hence the word we always talk about, playmaker. They just don't have that guy, and they haven't had that guy, and they continue to draft receivers to be that guy. Then they sign a free agent who's not just, you know, made like that. He's a complimentary guy. He's the number two receiver for a lot of teams, I'm sure. Kenny Britt could be, but not somebody's game breaker or playmaker. Is that guy on the roster? And we continue to look at Coleman to see if that could possibly be the guy. But, you know, Brock Osweiler, if he's not going to have Kenny Britt making plays for him, somebody's going to have to.
No, you're right. And when, you know, you talk about Corey Coleman, he's had a solid training camp. Didn't do a ton in the preseason opener, but didn't get a lot of chances. But you still wonder, can he be a guy like an Odell Beckham? And that's a huge leap from what we saw last year to a Pro Bowl-type receiver. Now, he's got some explosion, you know, he's got some quickness, but, you know, I haven't seen the one-handed catches. I haven't seen the acrobatics that you see from Odell Beckham, and he doesn't have the size of a Julio Jones or a Calvin Johnson. So if you don't have that, then you got to be special in other areas, and I just haven't seen enough from Coleman. And when you look at the best offenses in the league, they have guys like that. They have guys where the defense goes into it going, man, we got to double team this guy, and he still might kill us. And the Browns just don't have that guy, which makes it a grind. You know, it means Hugh Jackson's got to be better with every play call. It means the line's got to block better. The quarterback's got to throw it more accurately because you don't have a guy that can kind of save a bad play. And until they have that guy, it's going to be a struggle offense.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what, you know, has plagued a lot of Browns quarterbacks. Not that they've had any Pro Bowlers that would have been better, you know, would have been Pro Bowlers had they had better receivers, but all the Browns quarterbacks that they have struggled under for the last several years have kind of had that same problem. They just don't have, you know, a real game-breaking guy. The only close, you know, thing close was Josh Gordon for that one moment in the sun,
right,
which he led the NFL in receiving yardage and then, you know, promptly got banned from the league for the last 3 or 4 years. It's just that. Well, let me rephrase. Why is it that difficult if you can't draft one to develop a guy? And I'm not saying there are a million Odell Beckhams and Antonio Browns in the world that you can just say, oh, well, we'll develop him into one of those. But again, you know, it seems like everybody's able to find receiving talent in places that the Browns can't.
Right. Well, before I answer that, you made a great point. Derek Anderson in 2007 was the last quarterback to have a big-time year. And he had Braylon Edwards making those kind of catches. He had Kellen Winslow making catches and Joe Giravicius. So there's a direct correlation there. But as far as the Browns not being able to find their guy, it comes down to drafting, Bob. I mean, Ray Farmer ignored the receiver position for his 2 years running the draft. Sashi Brown didn't and took four guys last year, but we're not sure if any of those guys is any good. So, you know, and they blew their chance to take Julio Jones when Tom Hecker traded that pick for a bunch of picks. So, you know, there's been a bunch of reasons, but it boils down to the guy finding the talent has failed to find it at what's a crucial position, especially in today's NFL, where all you do, you pass the ball 60-65% of the time.
Scott Petrick is our guest. He is a Browns beat writer covering the Browns and the Giants tonight. From First Energy, let's talk about Deshaun now. Of course, as we always tell you and remind you, not that you didn't know, but he's a Toledo product, as well as a Notre Dame product. So everybody here is waiting and wondering, can this guy actually win the job? I don't think anybody expected when he was drafted that that would be the case, particularly as his college coach, Brian Kelly, didn't exactly have a ton of fond things to say about him when he made the decision to come out, saying he should have stayed, he isn't ready, isn't mature enough, etc. Can you evaluate the maturity of Deshaun Kizer, Scott? That's question one, or 1A. And 1B would be, what does he have to do tonight to overtake Brock Osweiler? Is it even possible?
His off-the-field maturity, Bob, from what I've seen, has been outstanding. You know, I think he's handled all the questions. He came in, and, you know, I think it was the first time we talked to him after the draft, and he said, you know, oh, yeah, I want to be the guy week one, and he talked about having the skills of a Brady and a Cam Newton. You know, he didn't say he had the skills, but he thought he could be that type of quarterback. But after that, the Browns talked to him, and they said, hey, you got to slow down here. You know, we're not expecting you to play right away. You got a ton to learn. And he's embraced that. And he's towed the line since then, and I've liked everything I've seen from him. You know, he's running sprints after practice. Everybody raves about him inside the building. So, to me, that hasn't been a problem, and you just kind of question why Brian Kelly would even say something about a guy that played it for him and under him. As far as winning the job, he's got to take that next step from what he did last week, and I thought he played great against the Saints. He showed poise that I hadn't necessarily seen in the pocket. I liked his movement skills inside the pocket. Now, sure, he held the ball too long on a couple of sacks, and he missed some guys underneath. Some easy throws where you check it down, you get second and five, instead he takes a sack, and now it's second and 15, and the drive's blown up. But that's his first NFL game action. He's going to get better. He's smart enough. He works hard enough. Now, the question is, will Brock Osweiler play poorly and Deshaun Kizer play well tonight? And if that combination happens, then I think Hugh Jackson's going to have to reevaluate, and it wouldn't shock me in the least if he said, you know what, the gap between Osweiler and Kizer is close enough as far as who gives us the best chance to win week one against Pittsburgh. I'm going to go with the kid and see what he's got.
Is it all about who gives you a best chance to win week one against Pittsburgh, or should or will Hugh Jackson look at the big picture? And that is not who can help me win right now, but if he isn't ready right now and I rush him in there, can I damage him long-term? Confidence,
right.
Let alone injuries, of course. But if I rush the rookie in there because he gives me the best chance right now, but the learning curve is going to be so steep, he's going to do a lot of damage to himself, perhaps psychologically, that maybe that isn't the right thing to do.
Well, that's truly being what they're considering, and that's the approach the Browns have taken, that they want to bring him along slowly. Hugh Jackson talked about it, I think it was Thursday, where he said, you know, if you play a guy that's not ready, you make him susceptible to hits because either he's not picking up the blitz right or he's hanging out of the ball too long. Because these guys only have so many hits in them. So physically, you don't want to expose him to that. And psychologically, you don't want to kill a guy's confidence. Now, we can argue about whether or not you should be mentally tough enough to handle anything that can be thrown at you. From a confidence-shattering perspective, Derek Carr went 0-10, Peyton went 1-15, Troy Aikman went 1-15, and they're fine. But the Browns have taken the approach of, let's not ruin this kid right away. And I get that, but you have to have an alternative. Brock Osweiler has to be a better option, and you have to be worried about Kizer. And I haven't seen enough to be worried where I don't think he can handle it. Now, I'm not in the meetings with him. You know, I don't see him 24-7 like his coaches do. But to me, it wouldn't be a disaster if you said, you know what, let's start this kid against Pittsburgh.
Scott Petrak is our guest. Scott is on the Browns beat. You can read all of his great work, his analysis, his opinions, his game stories, his side stories. It's all at brownszone.com. Not Brown Zone, Browns Zone, one word, .com. Make sure you check him out there. What about Isaiah Crowell? This is a guy, and I don't think we talked about him much last week, Scott, but he was talking to the media about being one of the top three or four backs in the league. He feels like he is one of them. His numbers, his overall production doesn't show it, but it's only because he didn't get enough carries. And if you look at his yards per carry, he may have a point. On the other hand, guys who are considered to be the top backs in the league now, Le'Veon Bell, David Johnson types, are catching a ton of passes out of the backfield.
Right.
They're playing all three downs. They're not subbed out on for a specialist on third down. How good can he be, and have you seen enough of that development thus far in the preseason to know that he's ready to take that next step up into the top echelon of backs?
I think he is, Bob. Now, I don't know if he'll ever be a top three or five. You know, I just don't know if he's gifted as Le'Veon Bell is, you know, or David Johnson, but he's close. And I think he's a powerful runner, which those guys aren't necessarily. You know, Le'Veon Bell is more of a scat back. He, you know, waits and waits. He's got such good patience. While Crow is, he can stick his head up in there, and he can run away from guys. The key for him, like you mentioned, it's going to be, can he catch the ball? And I think he's going to get the opportunity this year because Duke Johnson is going to play a lot in as a slot receiver. So I think you can see on third down, Johnson split out, Crow in the backfield, and that means he'll be that check down guy. He'll be the outlet for whoever's playing quarterback. And all of a sudden, if he catches 40 balls and runs for 1,300 yards, which to me is not out of the question at all, all of a sudden you're looking at a top 10, top 12 back, and he's going to get paid because this is a free agent year.
A couple more quickies, Scott. We'll let you run as you get ready for the Browns and the Giants tonight. Monday Night Football preseason action for the Browns. We talked so much about Myles Garrett, and we talked about some of the newcomers to the Browns defense. You know, the old steady, well, he used to be steady before he kept getting hurt, and before he started getting hurt, he kind of was getting burned. But Joe Hayden isn't really on anybody's lips, at least that I have noticed a whole lot of during the Browns camp. The veteran cornerback was thought to be one of the top few cover corners in the game. He wanted to be known as a lockdown guy, a Revis guy, a Peterson guy. Really hasn't been that, maybe because of those injuries. But is he poised for a full 16-game season, and will it be at the level that he expects out of himself?
Well, Bob, it feels like forever ago, but it was only 2014 when Joe went to his second straight Pro Bowl. Since then, he had the concussion that cost him 10 games. Mm-hmm. Then last year, he had tears to both groin muscles. And that, you know, he played through it, but he wasn't the same guy. So Joe says he feels great, says he feels 100%. He's been getting days off just because the Browns want to make sure he gets to week one healthy. You know, he's still in the prime of his career. I think he's 28, so he's still got a couple really good years in his prime. And he's devoted and committed to returning to the Pro Bowl and being that type of player, but he's got to prove that he can stay healthy. I mean, every time we talk to the coordinator, Greg Williams, that's what he says. It's all about can Joe stay healthy, which is almost out of Joe's hands, you know. And he's going to get a test tonight. He's going to play Odell Beckham. And you're going to see if Joe can turn and run with one of the top two or three receivers in the league. And if he can, I think it'll answer some doubts about whether he can be your number one corner during the season.
Yeah, that's, you know, you mentioned the matchup with Beckham. That was going to be my last question for you about him. And that is this. Let's just, for the sake of argument, assume five targets of Odell Beckham tonight in the first quarter or quarter and a half, whatever he plays. Let's assume five targets on Joe Hayden. How many does he catch?
Four
out of five. So and that's, yeah. Is that a testament to Beckham and Manning and their chemistry, yeah, and his talent? Or is it that Joe is still kind of working back into that form?
No, I think it's more Eli and Odell. You know, I just think that they're so good together. You know, if one of those isn't a 35-yarder, that's okay. You know, if Joe gives up four hooks, you know, a comeback or an out, that's not a big deal. But if you see him turn and run and he can't keep up with Odell and turns into a 55-yard touchdown, then Greg Williams is going to have to think, okay, can this guy cover A.J. Green and Antonio Brown week one? I mean, that's a matchup week one.
That's right.
You got to figure out how you're going to cover them.
That's a great point. Last thing, Myles Garrett, the rookie, he's been called by Greg Williams. How did he phrase it? Fastest learner. I can't remember exactly how I said it.
Rookie, yeah, fit in the best. Yeah, fit in the best of any highly drafted rookie that he's ever seen. Yeah.
Yeah. Does he get his first sack tonight?
I think he does. I think he came close last week, didn't play a ton. He's going against Eric Flowers, who isn't the best left tackle. I think Eli goes down.
Last thing I see on your webpage, Browns Zone with Scott Petrak. Again, Browns Zone, there's a tab called On the Air. I see Rhoda. I see Locker Room. I'm waiting to see Extravaganza. That'll be on, up there tomorrow, right?
Yeah, you put it, if, as long as there's a link to it, I'll put it up there, buddy.
We'll make sure you have the link, my friend. Scott, keep up your great work. Great job with the site. I mean, I didn't think you could do much better than you did with your writing and your columns and your coverage, but the website's terrific, so keep up the great work.
Hey, I really appreciate it, Bob.
You got it. Thank you, my man. Scott Petrak joining us. All right, going to get out here, get a quick timeout. After the bottom of the hour Sports Center, we're going to quickly shift into college football mode. Why? Well, because the AP Top 25 was released today at noon. Chris Lowe of ESPN.com is going to analyze the Top 25 preseason style. I don't put a lot of stock into it, but a lot of people do. Chris is one of them, and we'll see what he has to say about the number two ranked, yeah, spoiler alert, number two ranked Ohio State Buckeyes in the preseason AP Top 25. That part of the conversation is coming up next right here on The Ticket.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed. Right back with you on the extravaganza. It is 4:32. Great stuff on the Lions from our man Jeremy Reisman from, or Reisman, beg your pardon, from PrideOfDetroit.com. Great stuff from Scott Petrak on the Browns at BrownsZone.com. They've got preseason game number two coming up tonight. And now, time to talk a little college football. The AP Top 25 poll was released just today, and you know what they had to say. It is
Alabama.
That's right, Forrest. Alabama, number one, not the Ohio State Buckeyes, who check in at number two. And joining us now to make a little sense of and break down the preseason top 25 from ESPN.com, Chris Lowe. Chris, thanks for joining us here in Toledo this afternoon. How the heck are you?
I'm great, guys. It's good to be with you.
It is good to have you aboard. Jim Cushlin, of course, is along here with us. He may have a question or two as we go on. So, it is indeed the Crimson Tide, who lost the national championship game to Clemson. It seems like a lifetime ago. It was back, obviously, in early February, or no, wait, January, beg your pardon. It was the Super Bowl. It was in February. Get those championship games mixed up. But Bama's back. They got 52 out of the 61 first-place votes from the media panel. Do you disagree, Chris Lowe?
Well, the reality is preseason polls and who's number one in the grand scheme of things, guys, don't mean a whole lot. Now, as soon as I say that, I went back and looked earlier when the poll came out, and 8 of the last 10 national champions have started the season ranked in the top 5 of the preseason poll. So maybe, you know, maybe there's a little bit more to it than some of us think. I think you could take Alabama, Ohio State, Florida State, and throw them in a hat, and they're all pretty comparable. I mean, listen, in the last 2 weeks I've had a chance to spend time with the Buckeyes, with the Crimson Tide, with the Seminoles. I've been out to L.A. watching USC practice and also Penn State. So five of the top 6 over the last 2 weeks, I've gone to practice. I've spent time with the coaches. All of them are pretty close. I think right now, if you ask me who are the best 2 or 3, I think it's Ohio State, Alabama, Florida State, not in that particular that order, but all 3 of them look very comparable to me. And by that, I mean deep and talented in the defensive line, quarterbacks who are pretty seasoned and athletic and a lot of quality depth. And that's what all 3 of those teams, to me, that's the common denominator. And the great thing for us as football junkies is we get to see Florida State and Alabama go at it the first week.
That's a great point. I want to talk about, there are 3 matchups between preseason top 25 teams in week number 1, which we can talk about in a second. Chris Lowe joining us from ESPN.com. And, you know, what's interesting is I've always tended to think the same thing you did, which when you said that these preseason polls don't really mean anything until you gave the stat that you just did. But the flip side of that stat, a local writer here in Toledo points out that the past 12 years, the past dozen teams who debuted atop the top of the AP rankings at the start of the season failed to win the national title. So while it might come from the top 5 someplace, it is not very well, according to the last 12 years, it's not going to be Alabama.
Right. It's we just never see that happen, that someone's ranked number 1 to start the season, they go wire to wire. That's just, it's a tough road to travel. You know, there's so many expectations. But you know, it's a lot of it depends on health of your football team, your schedule. Everybody's schedule is different. I remember talking to to Roy Kramer, the old SEC commissioner, and he says, you know, the thing about college football that makes it so hard, no matter what system you're using to determine the national champion, is you're comparing all these teams from different leagues who play different schedules. It's never going to be apples to apples. It's always apples to oranges. You know, like the SEC, for instance, the way their scheduling works, some of these teams don't play for years. I saw a stat somebody put out a minute ago. The Georgia and Texas Stadium, for instance, won't play or haven't played and won't play again until after 2024. So there's that uneven, you know, the SEC doesn't play the league games, the Big Ten, the Pac-12. So there's just a lot of differences, inherent differences in the league that makes it hard. It really makes the committee's job harder, but I like the fact so far that the committee seems to look, and they said they were going to do this, at teams' entire resume, not just pockets, not how a team is playing at the end of the season, but the entire body of work and who they beat and where they beat them, which, quite frankly, is the reason Ohio State got in last year and Penn State didn't. Although, if you talk to the folks up in Happy Valley, they're still pretty upset about that.
Well, you know what's even stranger, Chris, is just a few days ago, Urban Meyer made a suggestion that Penn State should have been in the playoffs.
Yeah, that was my conversation with Urban when I was there in Columbus.
Okay, sorry,
yeah.
I should have given you attribution
there. Well, and for context, I just asked him. I said, Urban, you know, had the roles been reversed last year, and you guys had won the Big Ten, and you beat Penn State, and they were the ones that went to the playoff, how would you have felt? And Urban, to his credit, was very candid. He said, listen, I would have felt empty. He said, I felt badly for Penn State. He said, they were a hell of a football team. He said, there's no easy way to do it. The committee's got a tough job. You know, I don't know whether you have four teams or eight teams. There are always going to be teams that feel like they're left out, just like the NCAA basketball tournament. He said, but no. He said, should Penn State have felt like they belonged in that playoff? Absolutely. And I think what he was saying was not so much that they should have been there and we shouldn't have, as if they had done everything they needed to do that year for the most part to make the playoff. But you can't squeeze six or seven teams in four spots.
That's a great point. Chris Lowe is our guest from ESPN.com. We're kind of analyzing and breaking down the AP Top 25, which was released at noon today. I'm going to ask you about a couple of specific teams, and then we'll get into a couple of matchups, Chris, and we'll let you out of here. Let's talk about Urban's Buckeyes. JT Barrett, 3 years ago, would have been a Heisman candidate had he stayed healthy. He got injured, of course, late in the season, had a tremendous year, and then Cardale Jones, you know, goes ahead and takes the Buckeyes to the national championship. Last couple of years, you know, of course, the year after, Cardale Jones starts the season as the starter, and it's a very odd thing for JT Barrett getting himself back into the starting lineup. And then last year he had it all to himself and didn't have the impactful season that he did 2 years prior when they won the national championship. What do you expect from a fifth-year senior like JT Barrett this season?
Well, the best thing to happen to JT, I believe, is going to be Kevin Wilson, the Buckeyes' new offensive coordinator. You know, Urban told me, you know, point blank, he said, listen, he brings a swagger to our offense that we didn't have, and the ability to be more explosive down the field. And I think that's where, so far in preseason, whether you talk to Urban, whether you talk to JT, and I talked to both of them last week, they feel a lot better about their quick strike ability. You know, that's something they just couldn't do last year. You go back to the Clemson game, when they didn't scratch, even the Penn State loss. I was up in Happy Valley for that game, and they just could not make the kind of explosive chunk plays down the field that you've got to be able to do. I think they'll be better at that. I think Wilson will bring that dimension, and certainly Barrett is talented enough to make those throws. I go back to his sort of coming out party against Michigan State a few years ago. I was at that game in East Lansing. He made some incredible throws down the field. I just think that, you know, having the confidence and the rhythm and the timing to be able to do that, I think Wilson, again, will be the best thing that happens to JT. And listen, there's no substitute for having a fifth-year senior at quarterback who's been on the stages that he has, who's played and delivered. I think he has a big year, and I think Ohio State offensively looks a lot more like we're used to Ohio State looking this year.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, the offensive coordinator is a big part, but he's got weapons to replace, too. Not that they're not deep. They are. You even talked about that when talking about Alabama, Florida State, and Ohio mm-hmm. State deep off the defensive line and deep in a lot of skill positions, too. Still, Curtis Samuel is a huge, huge part of their offense that has to be replaced now. Do they have the weapons that are going to step up and be as effective as he was for JT?
Yeah, I mean, Samuel was a special player, but I think a guy like Paris Campbell has a chance to be that guy. I know that they feel good about what he's done this preseason. He's a he's a running back, but they like the freshman from Texas, J.K. Dobbins. I mean, he's the one that I think can give them some of those bigger plays, those home run type of plays in the run game, maybe get them the football out of the backfield. But no, I think the way they've recruited, even losing a player the stature of Samuel, I think they're there. And again, having a fifth year senior to deliver you the football, you know, to get you out of bad looks and into good looks, which I think he'll be able to do, makes a big difference as well.
We're talking to Chris Lowe of ESPN.com about the top 25, which was released today at noon. Alabama is on top, followed by Ohio State and then Florida State. Let me ask you about Michigan, because here in Toledo, as you know, it is the ultimate border battle down in Columbus up against the folks up north in Ann Arbor. I don't understand how Michigan can lose as many offensive and defensive starters as they have and still be a top 11 football team. They, of course, check in at 11 to start the season. And we've all pointed out it doesn't mean much, but if somebody thinks highly enough, maybe of Jim Harbaugh's system, that he's got the right pieces to plug in and replace all of that talent that they lost. How do you see it, Chris?
Well, I think you nailed it. I think what Harbaugh has done is he's brought a respect back to that program. He's brought a culture back to Michigan football that's been missing. And even when they lose, and you're 100% right, they lost a ton of good football players on both sides of the ball, key guys. But the way he's recruited, the way he's been able to get them to play, I think at times over the last few years, the last 2 years, I think they've played over their head. You know, can they do that again with even more massive losses off this football team? We're going to find out. Are they truly a top 10 or top 15 team? But the good thing for Michigan fans is, now, when I say they're back, I don't mean they're back getting ready or on the cusp of winning a national championship,
right,
but they are relevant again nationally. You know, Michigan football guys, and this is not a shot at any coach or any one era, has been sort of boring for a while. You know, well, it's not boring anymore. You know, and Harbaugh has sort of brought that, you know, again, he's brought that dimension back to the program. Hey, just like we were talking about Florida State, Alabama a minute ago, we find out a lot about Michigan first week. They play Florida at a neutral site. Both of those teams looking to sort of set the right tone for the season. I think the winner of that game, that Michigan-Florida game, has a chance to have a really good season. The loser, you know, maybe it goes the other way.
Real quick, before I ask you about week one games, and there's only those top 25 ones we want to hit you with, Chris, but just I'm looking at the top 11 just because that's where Michigan is, and that means four Big Ten teams in the top 11. Does that make the Big Ten the best? And it's preseason, but for now, does that make, reputation-wise, I guess, is the Big Ten the best conference in college football, a title that's always been held by the SEC in the minds of many?
Well, and three of those teams in the same division.
That's great.
You know, I think it's right there. Here's my thing on the best conference argument. And you're right. When the SEC won seven straight national championships, it was supposedly a runaway race. They were better, heads and shoulders, than everybody else. Well, that was the BCS year. A lot of people had problems with that format. And there probably were, you know, some inherent biases in it. But I think what's happened is I think the Big Ten and the ACC have just gotten better. And I think the SEC still is a heck of a conference. And I don't know that the SEC has gone backward as much as the Big Ten and the ACC have gone forward. I think the Big Ten's right there. Look at the coaching lineup, the head coaching lineup of the Big Ten, and compare to what it was 5-6 years ago. With Urban and Harbaugh, what D'Antonio's done at Michigan State.
James Franklin,
and he's taken that program. The Penn State program, this could have been a serious backslide there, and he's taken it, and they are going like gangbusters. Paul Chryst at Wisconsin, you know, just quietly has that program year, you know, has that program right there among, you know, the national contenders every year. So, right on down the line, and of course that's not, it's leaving out some of the guys that have been there for a while. I think the head coaches in that league, if you ask me, you can take the top five head coaches in any league in America right now, the Big Ten would be my league.
That's an amazing thing. Because you know what? Before the Harbaugh hiring, I mean, a lot of us said, particularly again here in this part of the state, in this part of the Midwest, we kind of said for the Big Ten to be the Big Ten, Michigan has to get back. Michigan can't be what it was under Rich Rod or under Brady Hoke. They have to become strong again, and they needed a home run hire. And I said at the time, Harbaugh, which I didn't think they'd be able to get, or Les Miles, would bring them back into being Michigan. And once you get Michigan back to what they were and have a true rivalry with Ohio State, even though Ohio State has still dominated it, you know, Urban and Harbaugh and now Franklin, that threesome right there is going to just bring so much more cred, and it's going to uplift the other Big Ten teams as well, because, you know, recruits are going to want to play in a conference like that, and surely it has really turned out that way over the last couple of years since the Harbaugh hiring, so it's just so huge.
Well, when Michigan and USC, two programs that have sort of been a little bit down, get back, and I think both of those teams, whether both ranked in the top 10 or 11 in this poll,
yeah,
college football wins. I think it's just better. It's a better sport, and I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah, it's a great point. We're talking to Chris Lowe of ESPN.com. Chris, I know you got a time limit here, so real quick, just on a couple of those top 25 matchups, number one against number three, you don't often get that. In week number one, and credit and kudos to the athletic directors and coaches at Bama and Florida State to say, let's do this thing early on, knowing that they're both going to be very powerful and that a loss this early, you know, could have some implications on how they are eventually evaluated by that committee as they try to fight for a playoff spot. What do you see in week one with that game?
Well, I think it's whoever offensive line can hold up the best going to win that game, because they both are just so good in the defensive line, the front seven, the way they rush the passer. So whoever are holding there the best offensively wins. And, hey, here's the great thing. As I really believe they're both good enough that if it's a good football game, I think it will be, that the loser of that game, if it takes care of business in its own league, we may see him play again in the playoff. I think they're both that talented in those that kind of football team.
I think that's a real good analysis, and they very well could. And you know what? In a way, even though I don't root for either one of them, I would like it because it rewards them for the challenge that they gave themselves in the beginning. Instead of playing the cupcake schedule and the non-conference portion of the schedule, to do this kind of thing and challenge yourself like that, I'd like to see that rewarded by the committee, and I certainly hope that kind of thing can happen. Again, just talking about a couple of the top 25 matchups, what are your thoughts on Harbaugh against McElwain, Michigan and Florida suspending seven of their players, including their top playmaker?
Yeah, that's a big loss for Florida. Callaway was their most proven playmaker, their most explosive receiver. And, you know, Florida still, you know, they just haven't been able to get it right at quarterback. And I'd say it's probably going to be Zaire. How does he plug him in? They've got some more talented receivers. Defensive line for Florida should be very good. Listen, it's really a tone setter for both those teams, because Michigan's a team. You're right. A lot of people are questioning, are they really a top 10, top 15 team? Florida's won the SEC each of the last 2 years. They got blown out in the championship game by Alabama and lost to Florida State. So for the team that wins this game, it's a huge momentum. I think Florida's probably, you know, a little bit better in the line of scrimmage defensively, but Michigan is one of those teams, again, and this is a credit to what Harbaugh's done there, has seemed to be that tough. They bring that physicality, that toughness, that physicality. I think outside Florida State, Bama, this is the game that I'm most looking forward to that opening weekend, the Wolverines and the Gators.
Who's going to be under center for the Wolverines?
What's that? I'm sorry. What'd you say?
Who's going to be under center? It's a three-way quarterback battle, Harbaugh says, for the Wolverines. Wilton Spate may get to keep his job that he had a year ago, the fifth-year senior of Corn fighting for it, and then the redshirt freshman why do I always forget this kid's name, for crying out loud? He's a senior.
Yeah, I got to think it's Spate. I think Spate will still be the guy. That he keeps his job. He's a guy. Now, does he finish the season? Does he finish the game? I mean, if there's that type of competition going on, I'm sure that, you know, Jim's going to play the guy that he feels like the hot hand, the guy he feels like gives him the best chance to win. But I think going into the season, Spate will be the guy.
Well, I'll tell you what, Chris, it's been a great conversation. It's an awful lot of fun to look at these things. I'm like you. I don't put a lot of stock in the preseason rankings, but it does make for good sports talk radio, and I'm sure for sports television for ESPN. So thanks so much for the time this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. Have a great day.
You got it. Thanks so much. Chris Lowe, ESPN.com, on the college football top 25. Christian, I can't remember which the other there's three top 25 battles between teams in the top 25 in week number one. It's Bama and Florida State, as I mentioned, and it's Michigan and Florida, which was the third because I seem to have lost.
Yeah, I'm looking that up too. Yeah, Michigan, Florida. Yeah, you I'm had just, the one. Florida State, Alabama.
By the way, I should probably.
Now you're saying top 25?
Yeah, top 25 matchups. There are three of them, and I lost the third
the
one.
The third one involves my Hokies, actually.
Oh, is it really?
21 Virginia Tech against 22 West Virginia, an old Big East clash. Okay. I remember those games when they were both in the Big East. Those were the ugly ones.
All right, very cool. So that it's down toward the bottom of the top 25, but it's there.
Yep.
I feel a little bit bad that we didn't get a chance to ask about the defending champions. Have you ever heard of a defending champion that lost their all everything, do everything quarterback like Deshaun Watson, stay in the top seven with a brand new QB and top five? Clemson is actually five in the AP top 25 poll. Same place in the coaches poll in the preseason. I feel like the Deshaun Watson loss should carry more weight than that. I'm not saying they can't be five. I probably should have asked Chris Lowe about this because the weapons that they've got coming back, I'm sure there are a plenty for the defending champions. But, this Deshaun Watson for Clemson last year and for the year before when they went to the title game again, was Vince Young for Texas, was, Reggie Bush for USC, and I'm just sitting thinking of Heisman winners, I suppose, but he was everything. And when you lose that guy, it's kind of like I said, Michigan, no disrespect to the guys who are coming back and the new guys who are going to try to start out for the Wolverines, in the starting role for the first time, but it's hard to prop guys up that high, number 11 for Michigan and number 5 for Clemson, when you've got so much that you've lost to the NFL or to graduation or whatever the case might be that you've got to replace. And Clemson, boy, that's, it might be a little bit high for me until I see what they have at quarterback.
Yeah, this is one of those that, you scratch your head a little bit and then complain about, preseason polls based on a lot of last year. And Clemson's got some tough games on their schedule that we'll figure out right away. Second week of the season, they're taking on Auburn. Of course, Louisville and Florida State are part of their division. And then end of September, they get my Hokies on a road game, and they, along with Miami, seem to be the favorites in that other division, the ACC. So we'll find out pretty much before the end of September how justified their number five ranking to start out really is.
Yeah, no question about it. So I'm really, really interested to see. USC, by the way, is interesting to me too. They got two first place votes for those who are wondering in the AP top 25 that was released today, and they might very well be the underdog, if you can call the fourth team in the country in preseason an underdog, and I think they are because the way Chris Lowe described it is probably pretty popular of a viewpoint that Alabama, Ohio State, and Florida State are the best three, and that there might be a significant drop-off after that. And if that is your viewpoint, and it is mine, then USC would be kind of an underdog to do this. But Sam Darnold is that good. And if the receiving core and the offensive line give him what he needs, I think he could carry USC to its first national championship in 12 years. And nobody's really talking about the Trojans as a national championship contender. They're talking about Darnold as a Heisman contender.
Right.
And maybe even the favorite. But I don't think you can separate the two. I don't think you can actually see Darnold as a Heisman favorite and not see USC as a national championship contender.
No, and that's an interesting point. Part of that possible national championship contender is you wonder what you're going to get out of Washington again. Of course, USC and Washington, that's different divisions, so that might end up being a conference title game in that Pac-12. Plus, obviously, until further notice, we're in a downslide for Oregon's program because I'm not seeing them anywhere on that list until we get down to those others receiving votes category. So part of the Pac-12, is wide open to see if something like that might be possible.
Speaking of the pack, we were packed today. Boy, oh boy. Great stuff from Jeremy Reisman of PrideOfDetroit.com on the Lions win. Great stuff from Scott Petrak of the, we'll just give him his website, Browns Zone, brownzone.com, on the Browns and Giants game tonight. And thanks to Chris Lowe of ESPN.com for the college football preview after the top 25 preseason teams were announced at noon today. That's all the time we've got. Great stuff. Thanks for being a part of it. Tomorrow, 3 o'clock, we're back at it again for the next edition of the Extravaganza. Stay where you are, because Drive Time is coming up next right here on the team.